Welcome back to Not Too Busy to Write. I'm Penny Winsor, author and book coach. This week, I'm in conversation with Sunday Times bestselling author Alice Slater. Alice's debut in 2023 took the book world by storm with her dark and original Death of a Bookseller. Her follow-up, Let the Bad Times Roll, came out this summer, and it's a sumptuous and twisted mystery about a missing English tourist in New Orleans. It was such a pleasure having this conversation with Alice about second novel angst, the joy of writing unlikable and immoral characters, and why Alice is not going to give up the day job anytime soon. We also talk about some of the immense practical challenges of writing as a shift worker. Let the Bad Times Roll is out now. Once again, this series of the podcast is brought to you by award-winning UK-based audiobook app, Zigzag. Zigzag's aim is to make reading easier and more accessible, engaging, and sustainable so that everyone can enjoy more books. I listened to Let the Bad Times Roll on Zigzag, and I am so glad I did. Wonderful performances by two narrators. It's atmospheric and totally delicious. Don't forget that Not Too Busy to Write listeners can get their second book completely free. All of the details are in the show notes. Thank you so much to Zigzag. That's X-I-G-X-A-G for sponsoring the series. Enjoy the episode. Alice, thank you so much for being here with me.
Thank you so much for having me. How are you doing?
I'm good. I am going to start just by saying that I was so excited to read Let the Bad Times Roll. And I want to just tell you this little story first. Please. In the summer, I was on the phone to my agent and we were talking about something. I can't, probably like when I'm supposed to finish the draft that I was working on. But she was about to go on holiday and she's like, oh, I'm trying to decide what to read. I've got all these options. I don't know what to take. I can have audio. I've got my Kindle. I can't take a hardback, but I can have a paperback. And I was like, oh my God, you have to read Let the Bad Times Roll. And she immediately said, oh my God, please tell me it's as good as her first. And I said, it's better. And she immediately, while I was on the phone to her, downloaded it on her Kindle and read it on holiday.
Oh, for a start, I love the fact that your agent just completely trusted your taste, was like, done, ready, let's do it.
Yeah. We have quite similar taste. And also, I love also she commits, right? She commits to a read. But then she said to me, and I loved this because I felt really similar. She's like, I'm so glad you said that, because she's like, I had a feeling Alice was just going to get better and better. And I was like, that's the feeling I had too. And it's true.
You know, that before I published a second novel, whenever I read an author's like second book and I thought it was better than the first, I'd be worried about saying that in case they took offense. I now know it's literally like the best thing you can hear, because I don't want to have written my best book already. I want to be progressing, but it's so scary of like thinking that maybe you haven't. Do you know what I mean?
This is the thing that I always used to think too, but actually, I mean, how brilliant that somebody loves your first book and loads of people loved your first book. And then you get to go on this journey with your readers where you get to take them in all kinds of directions.
That's it. I'm just like, trust me, gang. Get in the back. Yeah. Take you to New Orleans.
Well, okay. On that note, could you just quickly give me a little brief? Because the book was published a couple of months ago now. And in fact, actually, a few of the people on this series, because the books, I didn't do a summer series, some of the books have been out for a little while. And there's actually something quite amazing about having the conversations a little bit after publication, which I'm enjoying. But could you just quickly give me a brief few line synopsis about what this one is about?
Okay, so Let the Bad Times Roll introduces a man called Daniel. Everyone knows Daniel, but no one knows where the fuck he is. Am I allowed to swear on this podcast? I do swear.
Swear as much as you like.
Okay, good. I dropped the C word at an event the other day and I was like, oh, maybe.
Yeah, go crazy. You can do that, yeah.
You know, so no, everyone knows Daniel. No one knows where he is. His sister in London arranges what should have been a dinner party to celebrate his birthday, turns into a kind of inquest to ask everyone close in his life what they know about his potential whereabouts. Amongst them is a stranger. She is a psychic and she claims to have spent some time with Daniel in New Orleans. No one knew he was going on a trip. No one knows why he would be there. They're hoping that maybe she has some answers. That's it in a nutshell.
Amazing. Well, okay. I have to just begin with New Orleans because
I just was so, I loved being immersed in it. I enjoyed it so much. It is also partly set in London, but the New Orleans sections are just so incredibly immersive. And I wanted to start by asking, which came first, Daniel and his story or New Orleans?
That is such a good question, and no one has asked me that yet. New Orleans came first. So I had like famous second novel, like breakdowns, writing Let the Bad Times Roll. I had a 2-book deal, so I had to write a second book. I promised something about the world of psychics. That's what I was very interested in. Mm-hmm. That's all I really had. I wrote an entire plan for a novel set in the south of France. I had it beat by beat. It was going to be a thriller. And when I sat down to actually write it, I was like, this feels like just like a kind of generic middle-class holiday thriller. Nothing wrong with them. But I was like, it didn't match the energy of Death of a Bookseller. So I completely scrapped it. I scrapped every element. I didn't keep a single thing. And then started thinking, right, okay, I'm going to have to spend minimum 1 to 2 years in this book.
Mm-hmm.
So like, where do I want to spend that time? What's going to really excite me? What do I want to write about? And the answer was obviously New Orleans. It is my favorite city in the world. I've always wanted to write something set there. I've written some short stories, but I felt like New Orleans has such a huge occult scene. If I was going to set anything, it should be tourists. I've never tried and write as a local. And yeah, this felt like the right project. Daniel, however, took a lot longer to figure out because he's absent for most of the book.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, he's present in the New Orleans scenes, which are set in the past tense, but in the past rather. But it took me a long time to craft him. So I gender swapped him. He started off as a woman, but I felt that the dynamic between the two characters in New Orleans felt too similar to the dynamic between Roach and Laura in Death of a Bookseller. So I was like, I need to just mix up this energy. So while it was all still very malleable and new, I gender swapped and changed and played around and fiddled. And so, yeah, he actually ended up kind of blooming when I was quite deep into the writing process.
Mm.
But I hope you can't tell.
Not at all. I genuinely didn't know what you were going to say. It might have been Daniel that came first before New Orleans. Like, I genuinely didn't know.
Well, I am up to first.
And also Selena, who is in the New Orleans scenes, is another tourist in the New Orleans scenes, who I adored. And I wanted to ask you about this, actually, because, you know, I loved spending time with both of those characters enormously. I loved spending time with Daniel. He is the most unmitigated git in many ways. And I loved the ghoul in him, the kind of just unfathomable entitlement. But like, what a pleasure to spend time with a person like that. In a way, he sweeps you up. You can feel the kind of charm exuding from him, and you don't quite know where you stand with him. And with Selena as well, a thing I really loved about her is how much she grew and changed throughout the narrative. But it did make me think, I wonder if one of your specialties as a writer is writing characters who are underestimated, like wildly underestimated by the people around them.
That's awesome. Oh, I like that. I really like that. I'd like to think so. I think I'm very interested in characters as like onions with lots of different layers. Particularly, I think that's also how I build my characters, is that I start with a very broad sketch. Usually voice comes first, and like there may be their more outrageous actions that will appear later in the book are often things I think of first. So then what I'm doing is kind of writing a psychological journey from how they got to where we meet them. So what they've experienced in their past and what kind of informs the choices they make. And then, you know, how I can get them from a state of like, you know, a kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like,
atheist?
A neutral state, you know, like they start off in a neutral space, and how I can take them to the kind of extreme place I want them to end up in.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they kick off quite wild, but I want them to go wilder.
I love that. Okay, I'm going to take that note on board, because actually I've been thinking lately, because one of the things I adore about your work is, and there's a number of writers that fall into this category of, when I read, I think, see how far you can take things, Penny. And I think that's something I really need to learn about fiction writing that I've been too tentative with. So I'm going to take that note of like thinking about the wildest things and then how to get them there. That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. But I wanted to ask about, in general, about this idea of likability in characters and how much it's come up in regards to your work. I'm sure it did come up in the first book with your main character, Roach, And I have heard you, I did hear you talk at the time when you were talking when it came out about not knowing before it went out into the world how people were going to feel about her. How do you feel now about putting sort of quote unquote unlikable characters out to the world? Because I personally love reading those characters. And I know there are a lot of people do, but some people do get quite obsessed with this idea.
Yeah, I mean, I was very worried about how people would respond to Roach. You know, I think it is always a bit scary when you have a character who's saying and doing things that are so far from your own kind of moral compass. It is worrying that people will misconstrue a depiction for, like, you know, God, you know, my brain today, man, I just came straight from a workout onto this. I feel like I am not functioning very well. But yeah, I think there is like this kind of assumption sometimes that depiction is an endorsement. Is obviously like quite a scary thing when you have characters doing really bad things. So writing Roach, I was worried about that. I didn't think twice about Laura. I was not worried about Laura. People absolutely hated Laura because she makes some bad choices. But I was, she's traumatized and she's really young. Like, traumatized people make bad choices. But that really surprised me. So I realized it's kind of all bets are off. Like, you can have a character do the most awful things and say the most awful things, and people be like, yeah, slay, oh my God, like, that's amazing. And then you can have someone who you think you've crafted like a really kind of believable emotional journey for, and people just like, oh, but she was chasing a man who's married. It's like, all right, yeah, but I mean, she didn't kill anyone. The other characters are dreadful things. Like, what the fuck?
That is so interesting, isn't it? Because one of the things I was thinking about, I was really thinking about, like, why do we sometimes, and like in reader reviews or when people sort of, you know, in conversation mention, oh, I didn't like that character. I wonder if part of it is if we enjoy reading about someone who behaves in a way that is not considered socially acceptable in whatever way, it's almost like we're judging ourselves a little bit as for enjoying. Like, I wonder if there's a bit of self-judgment involved where people are like, I'm not supposed to like this.
You know, I actually cannot stand the phrase, am I supposed to like this? Am I supposed to feel sorry for this person? I think it comes up a lot in like reader conversations and reviews and things. And I'm just like, there is no supposed to, man. Like, you're meant to be experiencing this. You're on your own journey. You're coming with your own context and your own experience. Wow. You have to experience it how you experience it. That's the joy of being a reader, is that you're bringing your shit to the table. The author can only bring heart, like, the story to you. It's up to you to interpret it through your own lens. So there is no supposed to. Like, it drives me crazy when people are like, am I supposed to feel sorry for Laura? And it's like, I mean, you could do, but like, I don't know. Like, it depends. She's done now. Like, it's up to you. Yeah, I think it's definitely a weird one. I feel quite fearless now. There are some things I would be more careful about, but only because we do have to have some sense of responsibility as to what we're confronting our readers with. On the other hand, yeah, I feel like when I read, reading is a safe place for me, regardless of what I'm reading, whether I'm reading something challenging or disturbing. Being in a world of words is a world of comfort for me anyway. I don't necessarily need more padding. I don't necessarily need to like the characters that I'm with. What I need to do is believe in them. I need to be rooting for something, whether it's their downfall or their success. I need to be invested. I need to believe they're real. I don't need pals in my books. I have pals. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need to feel safe with my characters. I want the characters to challenge me, surprise me, and I want to really, really believe in what they're doing.
That's so well put. I want to ask you a little bit about food and drink. There is so much delightful food and drink in Let the Bad Times Roll. Oh my God. I actually really just wanted to drink the whole time I was reading it.
I have received that note.
The response you need? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite a boozy gal. I love a cocktail. I love to be a little bit wild. I love nightlife. New Orleans, I think, it's a city built on flavor. So I didn't necessarily intend for food to play such a big role when I first came up with the concept. But, you know, the dinner party kind of creates the format of the novel. Like, each section is split by the course they would have been eating had the dinner party gone ahead. And it's all themed around the flavors of the city. It then felt quite natural. Like, you know, I love food. I love to go to nice restaurants. So I was kind of thinking, like, what do I love about New Orleans? Is the answer to that. I love everything about New Orleans, but the flavors are very unique. And we don't tend to get good Creole and Cajun food in the UK. Like, we don't have the same brands. We don't have the same, like, access to flavors. There are a couple of restaurants in London that are good, but nothing compares to New Orleans. No offense to those restaurants. So yeah, I was really like immersing myself in the flavors and how I like to spend my time in the city. And also, I feel like sharing a meal is a very bonding thing. And like, when you travel alone, which is what Selena and Daniel are both doing, it can be very solitary. It can be very difficult to sit in a restaurant alone. So you are so damn grateful if you meet someone that you can share a meal with. Mm. And so you need to create this kind of immediate sense of trust and camaraderie, which was helpful for the book.
And there was something so amazing about putting these two very different characters in the same city, both traveling alone, and just, it did get me thinking about, you know, all those times I've traveled alone and the situations I could have got myself into if things had not gone as well as they have gone. But there is something amazing, isn't there, about the fact that when we do travel and we do really put ourselves way out of our comfort zone in a way we wouldn't necessarily at home, and we often behave in a different way than we would at home as well.
I mean, I will say I am a rascal, so I'm not sure my behavior differs that much. I love chatting to people. I absolutely love chatting to strangers and hearing their stories, even if I am not particularly impressed by what they're saying or if they're, you know, kind of wild. That to me is really inspirational. And I do think there's something really fun about the people that you meet when you travel, that you will end up in conversation with someone that you would never meet in your ordinary life. And again, I think that it was something I really wanted to play with. Like, what kind of person would appeal most to these two people? Mm. Like, Selena feels like a fish out of water. She's very intimidated. She thought that she would be stepping into like a place that will feel like a second home to her, and she's immediately very intimidated by it. Whereas Daniel is not intimidated by anything. So I felt like that kind of, he's looking for someone that he can kind of take under his wing, so to speak. Selena was someone who will guide her. So I quite enjoyed kind of figuring out their relationship to the city before I figured out their relationship to each other.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, no, I can totally see that. Yeah, they made a really, really interesting pairing, the two of them. Really fascinating. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the structure, because obviously your first book is multi-perspective, but this structure takes things in like to another level in terms of both perspective and also timelines. And as you mentioned, it's broken up by over the course of one evening of these five courses, like remembering that right? Five courses in the present, essentially, trying to figure out where Daniel is. And then it's peppered through with the past as well. It's so complex. Well, it's not so complex. It's complex and it's delicious. It's like deliciously complex, you know, where you can really, like, as a reader, like, you feel like you get like stuck in, and it's so wonderful. I wanted to ask you, because I heard you, when your first book came out, you talked about how many drafts your first book went through with your editor, that you worked very closely together. Do you think that process gave you the confidence to tackle something meatier in terms of structure this time around?
No, I made a dreadful decision, which is that with Death of a Bookseller, it has a dual perspective. We have Rachel and Laura, past and present tense. It was originally just from Rachel's perspective, and I felt that it needed, first of all, to counterbalance Rachel's darkness. I wanted some lightness in there. I found that I was also kept writing about bookselling in a very romanticized way, because I loved and I missed it so much. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't quite sink fully into Roach's voice. So I scooped all that out, that became Laura. And that was a very complicated way to write the novel, because I already had all this, you know, I already had all this kind of groundwork done. I already had all this clay dug up for Roach, and I had to then stitch in Laura. That was really difficult. So for book two, I was like, and also of course by doing that, if I had to move something, it would knock everything out of sync. Yeah. So that's why so many drafts, they'll be like, oh my God, I have to write a whole nother Laura section, and there's nothing to say now. And it was a nightmare. Anyway, so I was like, okay, book two, I'm going to be kind to myself. I'm going to be chill. I'm going to write one perspective, one character, one timeline. And then I just fucking took the idea, booted it into the sea. I ended up with a billion timelines, lots of different perspectives. But it kind of happened quite organically. I think I started off planning that it would all just be from Selena, the psychic's perspective. Then I started writing Daniel, who at the time was a woman. And this voice came through and I was like, this I really like. I really like this. And it was starting to go too weird and it kind of ended up steering off in the wrong direction. I was like, maybe that's a different person. I don't write chronologically. I just scrap around and play around until I find voice. Mm. And I realized I had these different threads and I was like, okay, maybe I am going to do multiple perspectives. Then I dropped the dinner party concept to my editor at the time, who was the editor of Death of Bookseller, but she then moved on. I dropped this dinner party idea and she was like, love that. Absolutely love that. Let's do that. Let's definitely do that. So then I was like, fuck, now I've got two timelines and like three characters. And then from there, it just spiraled. I think I just stopped even trying to contain it. And then we ended up with I did make things easier for myself by choosing third person for the dinner party. So we're kind of head hopping rather than like sinking entirely into voice, which does make it a little bit less stressful. But no, it was a nightmare. I don't recommend it.
Oh my God, I love that. But it does sound like, in a way, even though it was a bit of a nightmare, that because you weren't doing it sort of partway through the process, it grew organically, that maybe actually it wasn't as painful as perhaps the first stitching together.
I cannot stress enough how deep into the process I was. I scrapped so many first drafts. I rethought so many different plots. Like, it's a very strange pressure. And because I work a day job as well, so it's not like I'm just at home free to do this like full time. So I was quite time poor. My brain was everywhere. And I had all these different ideas I was trying to wrangle. So no, I was quite deep in when I was like, actually, I'm going to yank this out. I'm going to change this. I'm going to rearrange everything. But I ended up kind of sinking into each voice, I think, by writing in this way, because it's a relatively big cast of characters. We have five people at the dinner. And then we have the missing man, Daniel. So we have six characters. By dipping into each of their heads and their pasts and their lives, it was quite an enriching way to get to know them and really figure out also through his presence and absence who Daniel is and like how each person at the table knows him from a different perspective. And they will think they know the real him. They think they know his deepest secrets. Mm. And they're all the real him, but also none of them are the full picture. So it's quite a fun, exercise.
Oh, that's so interesting. So with this one, I know when you were saying that the novel that you were thinking about writing, the one in the South of France, you had written up sort of beat by beat. With this one then, did you just sort of dive in with the writing and explore the characters and then start thinking about the story as it started to appear to you? Is that how you approached it?
Yeah. So the reason why I wrote a kind of a plan for the original scrapped second novel is I felt that Death of a Bookseller, I just like vibed my way through it and it was a nightmare to edit. So I was like, that's the wrong way of doing things. I'm going to try and do things properly. I'm going to be organized. I'm going to write beat by beat. I'm going to have a plan. I'm going to follow the plan. And what I really realized is that like going against the grain of your own brain is the worst thing you can do as a writer because it ends up just being a displacement activity. Like by the time I'd finished this perfectly crafted plot, I was like, well, I can't be asked to write it. I'm kind of bored of it. Nothing in it surprised me. It felt too logical. Mm-hmm. And actually I think like I want to surprise my readers. I don't want my reader at the beginning of the book to have a clue where we're going to go. I want us to go to some strange places together. If I've plotted it on the map already, you're going to see in my eyes, you're going to feel on the page where we're going. Mm. I actually found just like vibing, writing ahead and then coming back and changing things, deleting things, rethinking, reworking. I think it makes for a slightly more unpredictable experience from me as a writer. Mm. I really admire who are able to wrangle their brains and be more organized and disciplined. But I found that if I do that, I'm simply not going to get the job done. And the priority has to be to get the work done. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's what I always say to writers is don't go against the grain of your own brain. Anything to get the words on the page is good.
So I have you embraced this now? Like book three, are you vibing again?
Oh God, I hate myself because I just talk such shit. For book three, I'm not generally talking about it at the minute, so I'm not going to say too much.
We won't talk about what it is.
But I'm going to be demure. But book three is actually from one perspective. There'll be no other voices, but it's spanning a long period of time.
Okay.
So you're growing up with this voice. So even though it is absolutely killing me, I am trying to stick to a chronology because I need the voice to age up naturally. Even though it's kind of written from a retrospective place, so the voice can be consistent, but the character has to age up naturally. Yeah. So I'm quite stressed based on my previous editing experiences. at the thought of having to move lots of pieces to make them all fit.
Yeah.
So weirdly, for this book, for my brain, this is the right way to do it. But I'm still jumping ahead. And like, if I think of something fun, I'm like, well, we'll get that down. But I'm really resisting. I'm like jotting it and then leaving it. And then when I get there, I'll see where we are with the character and where she is and if that still makes sense.
Yeah. Ooh. Ooh, exciting. Which, what part of the process are you in the first draft still at the moment? Or are you...
I'm about 30K down.
Ooh. Ooh. Okay.
It's happening. It's happening. Love it. Ooh. In my household, we say once you hit 10K, you've got a stew on the hob. You've got a stew going. It's like an Arrested Development reference. So I've got three stews on the hob right now. 8K. Nice.
Love it. Love it. Oh, so I wanted to ask you a little bit about your day job, which you mentioned before. You are a copywriter.
I am.
And I've heard you say as well that you're sort of at the moment sort of not interested in getting rid of that job. You embrace having the day job. It's really important to you. I wanted to ask you about that because some people might find that a bit surprising that, you know, people might assume that as an author who has achieved some success, you'd be kind of, that anyone would be desperate to drop the day job as soon as possible. I wanted to just ask you about how that's all fitting together now with all your responsibilities, not just writing, but quite frankly, all the promotion of the book, which takes vast, vast amounts of time.
Yeah, man. I mean, so I work 4 days a week as a copywriter in a corporate environment. Well, I work for an agency, so it's kind of like chill and, you know, creative. But I specialize in financial technology. So it's as far from what I do in my fun time as possible. It's very hard work. It is absolutely really, really fucking hard work to balance it all. But the reality of the situation is I do not trust any debut or author who's still early in their career unless they have popped off. And I mean, big number popped off. It is very difficult to survive in this kind of economic climate that we're in right now on this, on the salary that you will earn, or, you know, the money that you will earn through selling books. The money is very precarious. It comes at really random intervals. It's completely unpredictable. You never know when you might get a little windfall from selling some foreign rights or, you know, something like that. So I'm prepared to give up the stability of a salary. I do not trust that there is a safety net provided for me by our current government. If things go tits up, if I fall sick, if my husband falls sick, I have to care for him. I do not trust that I will be taken care of. And I feel like I spend a lot of time saying this because I, you know, it's the dream, right? We all want to like be able to just create our art and that be our job. But we do not live in a country that celebrates or respects the arts enough for that to be viable. So any author who is claiming to be writing full time but does not have the sales to back them up, I guarantee they come from wealth, they're a secret landlord, they own property, they married rich, or they come from money. Guarantee every single time. I think it's like one of the most important things to be financially transparent as much as we can to ensure that people are not making bad choices based on what they're seeing other people present on social media. So, yep, it's unsexy, but I have my day job. I love it. I love my colleagues. I love not having to hustle hard. To make ends meet. I never have to stress. I have to stress because of everything is so fucking expensive. Yes. But like, yeah, let's not go crazy. but I really do value that the headspace that gives me. Yeah. I go into my office, or it's sometimes I work from home or in the office, whatever. But I log on, I do that job, and I don't really think about anything else. I can, however, still have the flexibility to respond to emails and be present, keep up with social media, whatever. But then I have like a nice, clean, smooth brain while I'm doing that. Then I can log out of that job and I do not think of it until I next have to log in. When I have done freelance in the past, it's fucking stressful. Chasing money, chasing work. Suddenly everything comes in at once and suddenly everything's cancelled. And then that's all just a distraction from the novel writing, which is my priority. So I've like crafted everything to ensure that I can do what I love, which is the novel.
I love that so much. I mean, I have been freelance for like 20 years and so more than 20 years, actually. So I am very used to it. But it's hard. It takes up so much headspace. But interestingly, I wouldn't, even if my next few books do well, I would not be stopping running a business. Like, there's just no way. There's no way. I've been freelance too long to know that I need lots of pots on the stove, basically.
Yeah. And I feel like you have to be relying on those payments when they do come in. They have to be big for you to be confident of like, okay, cool, I'm now set to like the next milestone in the book's life cycle.
Yeah.
And yeah, even if you earn, even if you sell a book for a big figure, it's mm-hmm. spread over so much time. Like,
time.
And you have to be so careful if you're going to like budget around that. Like,
yeah.
Although that said, if AI steals my job, which is a possibility, I don't think I would chase another job in this environment. Because what I like about this now is that I'm very comfortable. I know my clients really well. The whole point is that I don't have to stress about it.
Yeah.
So I think if AI steals the job from me, I probably would pursue freelance just because I think that would be the like smooth brain choice, you know?
And you can just keep strict boundaries around it of doing it certain days of the week or something like that. But yeah.
Try and do things that complement the novel writing. Like I love teaching workshops. I love editing. Mm. I love mentoring. I would try and do things that like kept me more grounded in the writing world rather than corporate freelance, which I don't want to do.
No, that doesn't sound very fun. It sounds like the worst of both worlds. I wanted to ask you about, because you were a bookseller previously for many years and switched to copywriting, and you have found it easier to write around copywriting than bookselling. And I wanted to ask you about that, because again, that might be something that people don't quite get their heads around, because often I've spoken to lots of people over the years that have really struggled to write when they're in certain kinds of jobs. What is it about the copywriting job that has made it a bit easier for you to have that headspace, do you think, that you didn't get when you were bookselling?
Every single element of copywriting has given me more energy and headspace. Even though it seems counterintuitive that I'm writing all day, like I will literally close one laptop and open another. The thing with bookselling is that it's shift work. So you have no regular pattern. The bookshops I worked in, I worked all over the Waterstones estate doing various different jobs. But often it meant working late. I'd sometimes over Christmas maybe work nights, working weekends. And just trying to balance an ordinary life of like seeing friends and socializing was difficult. Often you wouldn't even get your rota that far in advance. So like fitting a normal life around that kind of work was already quite challenging. And also it's exhausting. You're talking all day. You're kind of on stage all day performing. It's really tiring. It's physically very difficult. I was often working in shops that were very understaffed. So it was very physically demanding, very stressful. My brain was constantly kind of on fire of things I'd forgotten to do, things I had to remember, pressures of like keeping up with the shop. I loved bookselling, don't get me wrong. I absolutely loved it. And I was heartbroken when I finally realized that I had to stop. It was a really difficult transition for me. But immediately, I think the discipline of learning how to sit and write at a laptop for 7.5 hours a day facilitated the kind of dedication I needed to get a first draft of Death of Bookseller in. There's no way I would have got that book finished if I'd remained in bookselling. Well, I would have finished it. It would have taken like a decade. And it's not a book that needs to take a decade to write. Do you know what I mean? It's not like The Secret History. So yeah, I feel like making that shift gave me both the discipline, the time, the energy, and the inspiration to...
Oh, I love that. I think that will be so reassuring for people to hear that as well, because I think so often we hear all sorts of things about what is going to make it easier or harder for us to write. And what you've said actually makes so much sense to me. In my work as a writing coach, I work with lots of copywriters and journalists actually who want to transition to book writing. Them more than anything, I see succeed in terms of like getting proposals finished, getting out on submission to agents, because of the stamina they have built up in their day jobs. I think stamina as a writer is like one of the most underrated qualities that you can have.
I'm like, we're on camera, so but I am nodding. I'm like nodding along so hard. Like the stamina to be able to, especially when you're on deadline and like you have to make the deadline. That's contractual. But also you want it to be the best work you can. So it's not the same as just staying up super late, throwing together some trash for an essay at uni or whatever. Like, you know, you want to bring your best. And so you have to be able to do that for hours and hours and hours, often late into the night, then getting up early to start work again. Like it is so much work, but yeah, that stamina, man, it's like marathon running. You have to learn how to keep going for the distance.
Yeah.
You have to. There's no shortcut. You have to put down every word. And yeah, you can, you know, there's we do not live in a society that makes it easy to do anything, because we live in a capitalist society. So everything is profit driven, and the nature of creating art, the nature of writing, is that it's not profit driven. Like it has to come from a desire to to do the thing for the sake of doing the thing, because there is no guarantee at the end of payment. You don't know what's going to happen. So you have to love it. But even if you love something, sticking at it is really difficult. So even if you're just chipping away, even if you're just tapping 50 words in your notes app on the way to work each morning, that's still 50 more words than you had yesterday. Mm-hmm. That's then going to be 100 words than you had 2 days ago. So you can chip away. And I think that's also how I wrote a lot of Death of a Bookseller, was just getting little nuggets together and like shaping little bits at a time. Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, the editing process of being able to spend hours in it, mm-hmm, and focused is really challenging. But God, it's such a worthy muscle to like learn how to use.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to ask you now about this incredible series that you've been doing on your Substack, Books with a Twist, where you have been inviting authors to go enjoy a cocktail with you and have a conversation about writing and about publishing, the publishing industry. So delightful. I'm going to put a link in the show notes to your Substack so people can go check it out. It's so nice. But I just want to throw the questions back at you, if you don't mind. But I need to know, who in Let the Batman Roll would you have a cocktail with?
Okay. Oh my God, this is so fun. I can't believe that no one has asked me this before. Okay, so I think I would have the most fun with Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
But it would also, he'd probably ruin my life. Mm-hmm. I think I would have the least fun with Sage. Realistically, I think Selena is the person I probably end up being pals with. But also, I think I would fancy Richard.
Yes. Oh my God. I'm slightly freaked out that that is exactly what my thinking was. Which was like,
yeah, Daniel, I think I fancy him.
Trouble. Daniel would be so much trouble and I don't know if I could handle it. Selena, I would really enjoy. Sage, no. I would not enjoy. But Richard.
Richard, I'm like, talk to me, King. Let's talk about movies. How's the bouldering society? Do you still hang out with those guys? Like, I think I'd have a good time.
And very importantly, what would you drink?
I said, oh, okay. If I'm mixing myself, then I like to make a martini. I think the gimlet is ready for a comeback. And I love a really smoky mezcal margarita, particularly Tommy's style. So no contre and agave syrup instead of sugar syrup, instead of the contre. So if I make it myself, that's what I do. If I'm in a cocktail bar though, I really like go for anything that's like savory without being tomato based. So I'm not like a Bloody Mary girly, but if there's like something that's herbal or like has lots of chili in it, then I'm probably going to go for that.
Ooh, interesting. Interesting. I'm so glad you said gimlet. I went through a real phase about, I don't know, 20 odd years ago when I was living in New York, where I drank gimlets and I had sort of totally forgotten about that whole phase of my life. I need to revisit.
I'm telling you, I don't know when. I think maybe next summer we're going to see the rise of the gimlet because they're quicker to make the margs. They're in the same kind of flavor profile. And I think they're cheaper than margs as well. Like you can get away with a cheaper gin and have a legit cocktail compared to tequila. So this whole convo, I'm very aware. I stayed up very late last night being a silly billy drinking gimlets. Then I had to wake up early to do a workout and then I've come straight on this call and I can taste the alcohol on my breath. I'm so glad that we're not recording this in person because I would be melting your eyelashes off.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. Okay, you've inspired me. I'm going to make myself gimlet. It's been a while. But I just think I love this series so much. So I'm going to take it another step further and ask you the question that you always ask your guests, which is, if you were a few cocktails down, what would you say about the industry? What would you change about the industry if you could?
Man, not my own medicine.
No, sorry. It's a tough question, especially because we have to be careful about what we say.
This is the thing, is that I'm so fucking frank when I'm sober. I'm like, fuck, what would I say if I was a bit pissed? How deep would I go? Okay, well, I've already done the day job spiel. That's normally like first out the trap. What would I change about the industry though? Honestly, I think a decenter London would be my priority. I feel like it's very London-centric. And that has lots of ramifications. I think my friend Heather Parry, who is an incredible writer, if you've not read her, you should read her work. Heather always says, if you live in London, then you are playing a different game. You have greater access to the industry, from publishing professionals to events to work. So that would be my priority, is decenter London, spread publishing houses wider, get a more diverse cohort of people working behind the scenes. And I think that will result in better books.
Mm.
Although I also would just say that sober. I don't feel like that's like a shocking
drunk. No, you don't even need to be drunk. Oh, thank you so much, Alice. I am really bummed that we're not in the same room having a cocktail together, but this is the next best thing. So thank you so much for having this chat with me.
Thank you so much for having me. I've had the best time.